Chapter 25. The Tax Gatherer, Escape Military Service, and so on, and that finally the idea was hit upon of furnishing all the inmates of a house with one and the same surname, and then holding the house responsible right along for those inmates, and accountable for any disappearances that might occur. It made the Jews keep track of each other, for self-interest's sake, and saved the government the trouble for. If that explanation of how the Jews of Prussia came to be renamed is correct, if it is true that they fictitiously registered themselves to gain certain advantages, it may possibly be true that in America they refrained from registering themselves as Jews to fend off the damaging prejudices of the Christian customer. I have no way of knowing whether this notion is well-founded or not. There may be other and better ways of explaining why only that poor little 250,000 of our Jews got into the encyclopedia. I may, of course, be mistaken, but I am strongly of the opinion that we have an immense Jewish population in America. Point number 3, can Jews do anything to improve the situation? Apostrophe, I think so. If I may make a suggestion without seeming to be trying to teach my grandmother to suck eggs, I will offer it. In our days we have learned the value of combination. We apply it everywhere in railway systems, in trusts, in trade unions, in salvation armies, in minor politics, in major politics, in European concerts. Whatever our strength may be, big or little, we organize it. We have found out that that is the only way to get the most out of it that is in it. We know the weakness of individual sticks and the strength of the concentrated faggot. Suppose you try a scheme like this, for instance. In England and America, put every Jew on the census book as a Jew. In case you have not been doing that, get up volunteer regiments composed of Jews solely, and when the drum beats, fall in and go to the front, so as to remove the reproach that you have few Messinas among you, and that you feed on a country, but don't like to fight for it. Next, in politics, organize your strength, band together, and deliver the casting vote where you can, and, where you can't, compel as good terms as possible. You huddle to yourselves already in all countries, but you huddle to no sufficient purpose. Politically speaking, you do not seem to be organized, except for your charities. There you are omnipotent. There you compel your due of recognition. You do not have to beg for it. It shows what you can do when you band together for a definite purpose. And then from America and England you can encourage your race in Austria, France, and Germany, and materially help it. It was a pathetic tale that was told by a poor Jew a fortnight ago during the riots, after he had been raided by the Christian peasantry and despoiled of everything he had. He said his vote was of no value to him, and he wished he could be excused from casting it, for indeed, casting it was a sure damage to him, since, no matter which party he voted for, the other party would come straight and take its revenge out of him. 9% of the population, these Jews, and apparently they cannot put a plank into any candidate's platform. If you will send our Irish lads over here, I think they will organize your race and change the aspect of the Reichsrat. You seem to think that the Jews take no hand in politics here, that they are absolutely non-participants. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I am assured by men competent to speak that this is a very large error, that the Jews are exceedingly active in politics all over the empire, but that they scatter their work and their votes among the numerous parties, and thus lose the advantages to be had by concentration. I think that in America they scatter too, but you know more about that than I do. Speaking of concentration, Dr. Herzl has a clear insight into the value of that. Have you heard of his plan? He wishes to gather the Jews of the world together in Palestine, with a government of their own under the suzerainty of the Sultan, I suppose. At the convention of Bern, last year, there were delegates from everywhere, and the proposal was received with decided favor. I am not the Sultan, and I am not objecting, but if that concentration of the cunningest brains in the world were going to be made in a free country bar Scotland, I think it would be politic to stop it. It will not be well to let that race find out its strength. If the horses knew theirs, we should not ride any more. Point number 5. Will the persecution of the Jews ever come to an end? Apostrophe, on the score of religion, I think it has already come to an end. On the score of race prejudice and trade, I have the idea that it will continue. That is, here and there in spots about the world, where a barbarous ignorance and a sort of mere animal civilization prevail, but I do not think that elsewhere the Jew need now stand in any fear of being robbed and raided. Among the high civilizations he seems to be very comfortably situated indeed, and to have more than his proportionate share of the prosperities going. It has that look in Vienna. I suppose the race prejudice cannot be removed, but he can stand that. It is no particular matter. By his make and ways he is substantially a foreigner wherever he may be, and even the angels dislike a foreigner. I am using this word foreigner in the German sense stranger. Nearly all of us have an antipathy to a stranger, even of our own nationality. We pile grip sacks in a vacant seat to keep him from getting it, and a dog goes further, and does as a savage would, challenges him on the spot. The German dictionary seems to make no distinction between a stranger and a foreigner. In its view, a stranger is a foreigner, a sound position, I think. You will always be by ways, and habits and predilections substantially strangers, foreigners, wherever you are, and that will probably keep the race prejudice against you alive. But you were the favorites of heaven originally, and your manifold and unfair prosperities convince me that you have crowded back into that snug place again. Here is an incident that is significant. Last week in Vienna, a hailstorm struck the prodigious central cemetery and made wasteful destruction there. In the Christian part of it, according to the official figures, 621 window panes were broken, more than 900 singing birds were killed, 5 great trees and many small ones were torn to shreds, and the shreds scattered far and wide by the wind. The ornamental plants and other decorations of the graces were ruined, and more than 100 tomb lanterns shattered. And it took the cemetery's whole force of 300 laborers more than 3 days to clear away the storm's wreckage. In the report occurs this remark, and in its italics you can hear it grit its Christian teeth. Letiglich die Israelitische Abteilung des Friedhofs vom Gelwitter Ganslich version word in war. Not a hailstone hit the Jewish reservation. Such nepotism makes me tired. Point number 6. What has become of the golden rule? It exists, it continues to sparkle, and is well taken care of. It is exhibit A in the church's assets, and we pull it out every Sunday, and give it an airing. But you are not permitted to try to smuggle it into this discussion, where it is irrelevant, and would not feel at home. It is strictly religious furniture, like an acolyte, or a contribution dash plate, or any of those things. It has never intruded into business, and Jewish persecution is not a religious passion, it is a business passion. To conclude, if the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world, in all the ages, and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself, and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed, and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up, and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal to the Jew, all other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Postscript: The Jew, a soldier. When I published the above article in Harper's Monthly, I was ignorant, like the rest of the Christian world, of the fact that the Jew had a record as a soldier. I have since seen the official statistics, and I find that he furnished soldiers and high officers to the Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Mexican War. In the Civil War, he was represented in the armies and navies of both the North and the South by 10% of his numerical strength, the same percentage that was furnished by the Christian populations of the two sections. This large fact means more than it seems to mean, for it means that the Jews' patriotism was not merely level with the Christians, but overpassed it. When the Christian volunteer arrived in camp, he got a welcome and applause, but as a rule the Jew got a snub. His company was not desired, and he was made to feel it. That he nevertheless conquered his wounded pride, and sacrificed both that and his blood for his flag, raises the average and quality of his patriotism above the Christians. His record for capacity, for fidelity, and for gallant soldiership in the field is as good as anyone's. This is true of the Jewish private soldiers, and of the Jewish generals alike. Major General O.O. Howard speaks of one of his Jewish staff officers as being of the bravest and best. Apostrophe of another killed at Chancellorsville as being a true friend and a brave officer. Apostrophe he highly praises two of his Jewish brigadier generals. Finally, he uses these strong words: intrinsically there are no more patriotic men to be found in the country than those who claim to be of Hebrew descent, and who served with me in parallel commands or more directly under my instructions. ...14 Jewish Confederate and Union families contributed, between them, 51 soldiers to the war. Among these, a father and three sons, and another, a father and four sons. In the above article, I was neither able to endorse nor repel the common approach that the Jew is willing to feed upon a country, but not to fight for it, because I did not know whether it was true or false. I supposed it to be true, but it is not allowable to endorse wandering maxims upon supposition except when one is trying to make out a case. That slur upon the Jew cannot hold up its head in presence of the figures of the War Department. It has done its work, and done it long and faithfully, and with high approval. It ought to be pensioned off now, and retired from active service. 1. See Stirring Times in Austria, apostrophe in this volume. 2. Here is another piece of picturesque history, and it reminds us that shabbiness and dishonesty are not the monopoly of any race or creed, but are merely human. Congress has passed a bill to pay $379.556 to Moses Pendergrass of Libertyville, Missouri. The story of the reason of this liberality is pathetically interesting, and shows the sort of pickle that an honest man may get into who undertakes to do an honest job of work for Uncle Sam. In 1886, Moses Pendergrass put in a bid for the contract to carry the mail on the route from Knob Lick to Libertyville and Kaufman, 30 miles a day, from July 1, 1887, for 1 year. He got the postmaster at Knob Lick to write the letter for him, and while Moses intended that his bid should be $400, his scribe carelessly made it $4. Moses got the contract, and did not find out about the mistake until the end of the first quarter, when he got his first pay. When he found that what Rady was working, he was sorely cast down, and opened communication with the post office department. The department informed his that he must either carry out his contract or throw it up, and that if he threw it up, his bondsman would have to pay the government $1,459.885 damages. So Moses carried out his contract, walked 30 miles every weekday for a year, and carried the mail, and received for his labor $4, or, to be accurate, $6.884. 4. The route being extended after his bid was accepted, his pay was proportionately increased. Now, after 10 years, a bill was finally passed to pay to Moses the difference between what he earned in that unlucky year and what he received. The son, which tells the above story, says that bills were introduced in 3 or 4 Congresses for Moses' relief, and that committees repeatedly investigated his claim. It took 6 Congresses, containing in their persons the compressed virtues of 70,000,000 of people, and cautiously and carefully giving expression to those virtues in the fear of God and the next election, 11 years to find out some way to cheat a fellow Christian out of about $13 on his honestly executed contract, and out of nearly $300 due him on its enlarged terms. And they succeeded. During the same time, they paid out $1,000,000,000,000 in pensions, a third of it unearned and undeserved. This indicates a splendid all-round competency in theft, for it starts with farthings, and works its industries all the way up to shiploads. It may be possible that the Jews can beat this, but the man that bets on it is taking chances. 3. The article was written in the summer of 1898. 4. In Austria the renaming was merely done, because the Jews in some newly acquired regions had no surnames, but were mostly named Abraham and Moses, and therefore the tax gatherer could tell t'other from which, and was likely to lose his reason over the matter. The renaming was put into the hands of the War Department, and a charming mess the graceless young lieutenants made of it. To them a Jew was of no sort of consequence, and they labeled the race in a way to make the angels weep. As an example, take these two. Abraham Beliak and Shmuel Gottbedumd, culled from Naaman Studien, by Carl Emil Franzos. From the London Times of 1904, correspondence of the London Times Chicago, April 1, 1904, I resume by cable telephone, where I left off yesterday. For many hours now, this vast city along with the rest of the globe, of course, has talked of nothing but the extraordinary episode mentioned in my last report. In accordance with your instructions, I will now trace the romance from its beginnings down to the culmination of yesterday or today, call it which you like. By an odd chance, I was a personal actor in a part of this drama myself. The opening scene plays in Vienna. Date, 1 o'clock in the morning, March 31, 1898. I had spent the evening at a social entertainment. About midnight I went away, in company with the military attaches of the British, Italian, and American embassies, to finish with a late smoke. This function had been appointed to take place in the house of Lieutenant Hillier, the third attaché mentioned in the above list. When we arrived there we found several visitors in the room, young Szczepanik, 1, Mr. K., his financial backer, Mr. W., the latter's secretary, and Lieutenant Clayton, of the United States Army. War was at that time threatening between Spain and our country, and Lieutenant Clayton had been sent to Europe on military business. I was well acquainted with young Szczepanik and his two friends, and I knew Mr. Clayton slightly. I had met him at West Point years before, when he was a cadet. It was when General Merritt was superintendent. He had the reputation of being an able officer, and also of being quick-tempered, and plain-spoken. This smoking party had been gathered together partly for business. This business was to consider the availability of the telelectroscope for military service. It sounds oddly enough now, but it is nevertheless true that at that time the invention was not taken seriously by anyone except its inventor. Even his financial support regarded it merely as a curious and interesting toy. Indeed, he was so convinced of this that he had actually postponed its use by the general world to the end of the dying century by granting a 2 years exclusive lease of it to a syndicate, whose intent was to exploit it at the Paris World's Fair. When we entered the smoking room, we found Lieutenant Clayton and Szczepanik engaged in a warm talk over the telelectroscope in the German tongue. Clayton was saying, "Well, you know my opinion of it, anyway." And he brought his fist down with emphasis upon the table. "And I do not value it," retorted the young inventor, with provoking calmness of tone and manner. Clayton turned to Mr. K. and said, "Gutenberg edition. End of chapter."